Hey, it's Andrew Siciliano. Coming up on Inside Coverage, John Harbaugh is out in Baltimore. The how and the why it went down after the Ravens' Week 18 loss in Pittsburgh. Also, are there teams out there that now fire their head coach to get a shot at Harbaugh? Jory Epstein is here. Frank Schwab is here. You are here as well. The coaching carousel keeps on spinning on Inside Coverage. There is always one surprise on the coaching carousel. I guess the question for you is, was this one in Baltimore a surprise? Welcome to another edition, a Tuesday after the regular season ends edition of Inside Coverage here on Yahoo. The how, the why, any and everything you need to know about the National Football League. Thanks for being here today. My name is Andrew Siciliano. Jory Epstein is on the show. Frank Schwab is on the show. Hello, friends. We talked about this last week. Jory wasn't here, but Frank, we talked about it a little bit yesterday as well. Where's the surprise going to come from? Maybe there isn't a surprise. Maybe we're done. Boom. Here's a surprise. Jory was at the Steelers' victory over the Ravens on Sunday night. Jory told us a few months ago, guys, keep an eye on Baltimore. Something might be amiss. Oh, yeah, it's amiss. After 18 seasons, John Harbaugh is out as head coach of the Ravens, and this is not a mutual parting of the ways. Agree to go their separate directions. Jory, this is a firing, evidently. Wow.
Yeah, I got to be honest, I'm surprised. On one hand, middle of the season, we had to make predictions. I had predicted this because I'd been hearing from people around the league. There was this tension between Lamar Jackson and John Harbaugh, and there was these losing streaks, even if Lamar was injured at the time. And there was kind of this question of the roster felt more talented than its win-loss record was reflecting. And then a week ago, when you asked for surprises, I was like, actually, I don't think this anymore. And I think that Tomlin and Harbaugh will stay put. I think when this comes down to it, both Harbaugh and the Ravens should know that they're now the most attractive ones in their respective markets. Yeah. Harbaugh is immediately the most attractive coach on the market, and the Ravens are immediately the most attractive franchise for any coach considering a head coaching job or being interviewed for head coaching jobs. That doesn't mean that they should have stayed together. To me, there is a time where the voices aren't working anymore. The system isn't working anymore. And I don't mean schematic system. I just mean the program in terms of, are you maximizing the people in the building? And I think the Ravens got there. So I don't believe that John Harbaugh is not the best coach out there now, or that the Ravens aren't the best opening. But I actually do believe this was the time. And I don't believe that because Tyler Lute missed a field goal. I believe that this had been brewing for years. And at some point, you just got to do it. And you can't keep pushing it down the road because the tension will only continue to build.
No, I think that's a great point. I saw, you know, in the aftermath, everybody saying, oh, so if Tyler Lute makes a field goal, Harbaugh stays? No, I don't buy that for a second. The Ravens,
at least one more week.
And that, if, you know, look, if they make a deep run and make a Super Bowl, maybe things change. Who knows? But the Ravens aren't one of these dumb organizations that say, well, we missed the playoffs, we got to fire the coach. Like, they're way smarter than that. And there's been a lot going on, as you've chronicled, Jory. And you can just see it. If you've followed the Ravens at all this season, it has been off. Everything has been off. Everything has been bad. Everything is just, and you get the sense of, you're right, maybe this is just time for a change. You don't know that you're probably not going to get a coach better than John Harbaugh. That's just the truth of it. But you also have to take a look and say, is what we're doing working? I've talked many times before. All the things we've said about Tomlin through the years actually apply to Harbaugh too, the lack of postseason success. Everybody puts the Ravens' recent playoff failures on Lamar Jackson's shoulders without pointing a finger and saying, maybe John Harbaugh not getting to a Super Bowl without one of the greatest quarterbacks ever is on him, too. So all this stuff kind of comes to roost. Then you have this terrible season. It just seemed like inevitable by the end of it. It didn't surprise me, honestly. Like, it would have, I think it would honestly would have surprised me a little more if he came back. It was just been brewing for so long, and they had such a disappointing season that I think ownership had to hear the clock ticking on Lamar Jackson's prime. This, we've talked about this. He's not going to be a guy who's still balling out at 37 years old. I don't think, anyway. I hope so, but I don't think so. They know that there's a limited window here, and they've wasted a lot of it already. And just running it back after that season probably didn't make any sense.
So I'm looking down here because as we're talking, both the Ravens and John Harbaugh, the latter of which was through the team, so much like with the Browns with Kevin Stefanski yesterday, a statement from the coach through the team, have released statements. Now, to your point about not winning much, they're like the Steelers and Tomlin. The Ravens, since that night, the lights went out in New Orleans when Harbaugh beat Harbaugh and won the Super Bowl. That was 2012. The Ravens have not won multiple playoff games in any season. So if they get in, to your point, Frank, they are one and done. They've missed the playoffs this year. They went 8-9 for the first time since 2021. The statement from Ravens owner Steve Bisciotti confirms that it was a firing. Bisciotti says, I know if you're watching the video version, it's hard to read it. I'll read it from my phone here for you. Following a comprehensive evaluation of the season and the overall direction of the organization, I decided to make a change at head coach today. Today, I informed John that he has been relieved of his duties. This was an incredibly difficult decision given the tremendous 18 years that we have spent together and the profound respect I have for John as a coach and most importantly as a great man of integrity. He goes on to say that he's a Hall of Famer. He's going to be in Canton one day. We're going to find a new head coach. All the things that you would expect from a classy owner, and he is universally respected like Steve Bisciotti. And Harbaugh's statement is one filled with gratitude. It even has an emoji in the opening paragraph saying this was not the statement I figured I would be making today. John Harbaugh is going to be in the Hall of Fame one day. John Harbaugh is now the most desirable, the best candidate on the market. He can go to Arizona tomorrow. He can go to New York tomorrow. I'd hire him in Atlanta tomorrow. I think you also have to ask, Jory, we're talking about this off air, are there teams right now that have decided at least tentatively to keep their current coach who say, well, wait a minute, do we have to reevaluate this because John Harbaugh's available?
Yeah, it's a great question, Andrew. And I'm not saying that the teams who feel really good about this coach or who are just getting started with some sort of era, like if you're the Cowboys, even if you didn't win, but you had Brian Schottenheimer, like you feel good about sure. the direction you're going. Obviously, if you're a team like the Chiefs, you didn't make the playoffs this year, you still got Andy Reid. But I think there are those teams that are on the cusp, like a Tampa, for example, who are like, okay, well, Todd Bowles, I don't know. Yep. That's mm-hmm. not really working. And he's seen Baker in the AFC North before, that I do think have to ask themselves. Even Pittsburgh, I would say, because Pittsburgh is a team who I get that they just made the playoffs, even if they snuck
That's
in.
Wild.
But I also
That's
think wild. If you're Mike Tomlin and you could either have Lamar Jackson as your quarterback or maybe an Aaron Rodgers retirement or 1 year of him, Mike Tomlin's number one thing that he has been missing for years is quarterback stability. And so I think that there's this question of why not. I also have to say, and maybe I'm reading too much into this, but on the note of the emoji, Andrew, so John Harbaugh's statement starts out with the line, quote, well, I was hoping for a different kind of message on my last day here someday, but that day has come today. And then he has not just any emoji, a smiley face emoji. And I get that it's kind of like a tongue-in-cheek, like it's not great to get dismissed from your job. I also wonder if there's any part of John Harbaugh that's like, I'm ready for a change, because we all know that when there's that
relieved.
Quarterback and head coach change, or head coach tension, I say, when there's quarterback and head coach tension, if you have a two-time MVP quarterback, it's harder to replace him, even if John Harbaugh is very hard to replace. And so Lamar was likely to win that battle. And both of them, given one's got the MVPs, the other's got the Super Bowl, would have reason to believe that they should be the one making the decisions. So it might be time that John Harbaugh's like, well, when did I not get all my power? Like, why did I lose this, given what I've done to this organization, for this organization, I should say, for 18 years? He might be ready to just have that power back. And again, obviously, that's at the cost of losing an MVP caliber quarterback in Lamar Jackson. But there might be some like, okay, now I can get back to how I want to run the show.
Well, you know, we go back to the Christmas Eve column that Mike Preston wrote in the Baltimore Sun, and we talked about this a lot, where Preston basically said, Lamar's got to change. I wouldn't give him a third contract or fourth, whatever it is at this point. He shows up late. He stays up late. They have to rearrange schedules for him. He sleeps in meetings. Harbaugh pushed back against that. Lamar pushed back against that as well. But I could tell you, I mean, stories like that have been percolating out there for a long, long time. They've been whispered for a long, long time. And when I read the column, it wasn't like, oh boy, oh my God, what a revelation. Because, you know, those of us behind the scenes a little bit and those of us that report, we've heard these stories. It was more, okay, why now? Like, Who ordered the code red? Why is this column finally being written now on Christmas Eve with clearly a feeling of discomfort there in the building between coach and quarterback? And by the way, it's time for Lamar Jackson to get his contract done. Again, he's heading into the final year of his deal. It's worth like $51, $52 million cash. That's it. That's the only remaining cash. So this is the time where you do a deal. And Jory, maybe to your point, he's like, if Lamar is going to get re-signed, which seems inevitable and probably the right move for the franchise, I just don't know that I want to do this anymore. Frank, I would also offer, because we're hogging the conversation here, that maybe at 63 years old, John Harbaugh doesn't know which emoji to use properly. And he just messed up. He doesn't have, at 63, the right emoji.
The smiley face does not require you to be a millennial.
Hey, at least he didn't use the eggplant, right? Like, that could have gotten awkward. But to build on something Jory said, I think this is what I'm hoping for. It's not going to happen, but bear with me for a second. The Houston Texans blast the Pittsburgh Steelers in the first round of the playoffs, like a 24-3 type of deal. Mike Tomlin decides, you know what? I want a different direction here. The Steelers say, yeah, you know what?
Go do TV. Voice,
that'd be great. Harbaugh goes to Pittsburgh. Tomlin goes to Baltimore. This would be the greatest story in NFL history. I would love it. It's never going to happen, but we can dream, can't we? But yes,
can you imagine if we said Mike Tirico did a great job on that game? Obviously, he did on Sunday night. But just the theater setting up all these storylines, the Ravens, the Steelers, and Akersher, and Aaron Rodgers is at his last game, and Lamar Jackson back from the injury, and John Harbaugh. And then you got the report in the pregame. Mike Tomlin just may go home and do TV next year, guys. He might just be done with this. But if you threw out the, what if I told you that when they meet next September, the coaches will have switched sides?
That would be awesome. Awesome. Like it would be just what storyline is better than that of two coaches who have been there 19 years and 18 years just switching, like
somebody
switch franchises. It would be a great experiment too. Like, was it really Tomlin's fault? Is it really Harbaugh's fault? Could he do? We would talk about this all summer on Inside Coverage if this actually happened, which it won't.
And Andrew, I'm curious, given that you're in the Cleveland building all the time.
Yeah, sure.
With John Harbaugh 1 and Mike Tomlin 2, if he becomes available, should Cleveland be wanting either of those immediately, given what they've done in the coaching realm, as well as their understanding of the division? Or do you think there's a better fit for Cleveland?
It's a great question.
I'm not saying they'll get him, but I'm curious.
I've already had in the last 25 minutes, friends who are Browns fans blowing on my phone saying, please, let's go do this. John Harbaugh is from anybody? Toledo, Ohio. He's got plenty of family still in Ohio. Family that are Guardians fans and Browns fans, although I don't know if they're Browns fans anymore because they're probably Ravens fans or Charger fans, understandably. Absolutely. John Harbaugh's got to go to the top of your list, period. Mm-hmm. He's got to go to the top of your list. I don't know that Tomlin would ever go do that. I just don't think he would necessarily. But don't forget, before the Haslams bought the Browns, they were minority owners of the Steelers. Now, granted, there's a very long list of minority owners of the Steelers. The Rooneys are right at the minimum threshold of controlling interest. They have a lot of partners there. By the way, not all those partners necessarily agree on Mike Tomlin. The Rooneys, I don't think, will ever fire Mike Tomlin. But not all those partners are lockstep, from what I've understood over the years, with the Rooneys, but that's neither here nor there. If Mike Tomlin ever became available and decided he did want to coach next year, yeah, absolutely. It wouldn't just be the Browns. It would be everybody. And I guarantee you, you would have teams going, maybe we do fire our guy. Maybe we do. That's why I've always said, when it comes to making a coaching move midseason, like if you're out of it, like if you're out of the playoffs, if it's inevitable, make it immediate. Like, do what the Giants and Titans did. Just get out ahead of it, because you could already go through this thought experiment, right? You could already put out feelers, whether legal or otherwise, to see maybe what your next move should be. So let's assume, guys, that Lamar Jackson gets re-signed. I'll give you the name Jesse Minter, the Charger defensive coordinator, who most people agree is going to be a head coach at one point sometime, son of Rick Minter, former coach. Jesse Minter was in the Ravens building, has institutional knowledge, is a defensive coordinator of high regard. I mean, that's the first name. And I, you know, tip my cap to Daniel Jeremiah, my friend at NFL Network who works for the Chargers, for throwing that one out there first. Jory, you want to spitball some other names?
Yeah, it's a great point because we've talked about these teams that should want an offensive coach to develop a quarterback. And I feel like Lamar Jackson gives you the luxury of saying, no, you don't need the offensive coach because you can get anyone. And oh, by the way, if there's a former head coach who, like a Cliff Kingsbury type or someone like that, who you say, okay, well, he's available, he can kind of guide a new defensive, a first-time head coach who has a defensive background, he can weigh that and totally take control of the offense. And any of those guys who are kind of, they've done this before, they're not looking for their first head coaching job, they should want to come to Baltimore to be with Lamar. So I think whether that's a Jesse Minter, whether that's a Chris Shula, whether that's Jeff Hafley in Green Bay, I think any of those defensive guys, honestly, Matt Burke in Houston, obviously you've got to see what Baltimore's prioritizing, but has any defense really looked better than Houston's defense this year? Mm-mm. I mean, they've been incredible. So I do think that there are some of those. I also have a question for you guys, but we can let Frank answer on Baltimore first, who you think would be the best candidates.
You know what? I love Jesse Minter and Chris Shula, the guys you named, all great candidates. If I'm Baltimore, though, I don't want a rookie head coach. Again, the time is ticking with Lamar. I need a guy who can step in there right away. I think Stefanski is a great coach. I don't know if he wants to stay in the division or whatever, but I think Stefanski, a two-time coach of the year, makes sense. Even this would be a tie for like even a Mike McCarthy. He can come in there, he knows the league. He has a ton of experience. He has Super Bowl experience.
Jory's making a face. Like that.
Aren't you we seeing like this Mike year? There? Like, look, I get that Mike Vrabel's having a good year and Dan Quinn last year had a good year, but aren't we seeing with guys like Liam Cohen, who not only is a first-time head coach, but also was like, GM, sure, get out of there, and guys like Ben Johnson, first-time head coach. Like, we're seeing all these guys, even Mike McDonald in his second year as a first-time head coach. All of these guys are getting to the playoffs and the best teams in the leagues. They're not just retreads. Yes, the Sean Paytons and Mike Vrabels and the guys we think would have success. Even a Kevin O'Connell, who Minnesota didn't have the best year. A lot of the best coaches right now were first-time head coaches. So it's interesting because I feel like I even have to check myself that recently I've been talking about what is a shallower coaching market. And a better way to say it for myself would be, there are not as many obvious candidates at the top of the pack before Harbaugh was fired. Now there's an obvious candidate, as there were last year. Yeah. But I don't know. I'm not convinced. I think Lamar gives you the luxury to not have to feel like you've got a guy who does it. And if you're getting a first-time head coach on defense, but you have a former head coach on offense running the show, well, the same way that Chicago had Dennis Allen running, and you can argue how good the defense looks, but Ben Johnson doesn't have to focus on the defense as much. I think that's the way I would want to do it.
A guy who honestly checks both boxes to me, Jory, is Robert Saleh. Great defensive coach,
yeah,
and has head coaching experience. I love Robert Saleh. I think Robert Saleh is going to be a heck of a head coach in his second job.
Yeah.
So I get everything you say is absolutely correct. Look, rookie head coaches have success all the time. Baltimore's got to get this right. I root so much for Lamar to make a Super Bowl because of all the dumb narratives out there about him that I just don't want. Liam Cohen, Ben Johnson. There's also Aaron Glenn. You know, like, you know, there's no guarantee your rookie head coach is going to hit the ground running.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm John Harbaugh, I don't want the Jets job. I don't care how many first round picks they have in the next 2 years. I don't want that job. However, if you're Woody Johnson, don't you at least have to call the people you trust tonight and go, what do you think? Should we maybe do this? But you also have to factor in the cost as well. And let's not overlook the cost, by the way, for Steve Bisciotti, because from what I understand, John Harbaugh's got multiple years, and that is not a small number. So we're talking, I mean, $30, $40 million on a buyout. It might be north of that. Head coaching numbers are not necessarily reported, and there's a lot of speculation, but I'm pretty sure he's got multiple years left on that contract. This is a hefty check that he is writing.
Is there offset language?
Check. I don't know. Most of these things have offset language, I'd assume.
NFL owners got money. Come on.
NFL owners got money. But at the same time, we know that the Brown family doesn't have the same cash flow as some of the other owners, but we're sitting here today saying that Duke Tobin and Zach Taylor aren't going anywhere, partly because they're owed a lot of money. He's not going to buy them out. Right? So owners do make those decisions sometimes strictly based on how much they're going to have to spend. Go look at Arizona, because Bidwill is now paying three head coaches. Correct me if I'm wrong, right? He's paying Cliff. he's paying. Who else is in there in between?
Gannon.
Gannon? But who? Well, there was he'll one other one. One.
I don't. Is there?
And he'll pay the new one. Yes, thank you. I'm sorry. So you're going to be paying three head coaches.
I think you were thinking a third one. Yeah.
Nobody wants to do that. Anyway, I.
Okay, well, I'm glad you said that because that's
come
actually
on. Stop.
That's actually a great segue to my next question because I want to ask you about the team who is probably paying more coaches than anyone, the Las Vegas Raiders. I am really curious what you guys think, both from the Raiders standpoint and from the Harbaugh standpoint, about whether either side should want the other. Like, if you are Tom Brady, are you now calling John Harbaugh and showing up at his door and being like, I need you? And are you trying to convince him that, hey, we have the first overall pick. We've got some guys on both sides of the ball. I get that Mark Davis is not the stability you're used to, but I'll make sure that I can keep him at bay if you're willing to come here. And if you're John Harbaugh, do you buy that? Could we see two Harbaughs in the NFC or AFC West this year?
Let me go first here because I'm actually coming to you today live from Las Vegas. I flew in for the CES, the Consumer Electronics Shows, to whatever, say hi to some people. Talk to some Raider fans, people around Vegas, rather, these events that are, you know, Raider friendly. And they're talking about Brian Flores. Hey, his contract's up. Mm-hmm. Tom Brady, go get me Brian Flores. I'm like, okay, that sounds good. Your defense is going to be great, even if you're, you know, the island of misfit toys and you're just putting parts together, which is what this year's defense was, Max Crosby and a bunch of street free agents. But I will ask, after seeing what happened in Miami, and I'm not suggesting that that quarterbacks aren't wired differently. Do you look at what happened between Flores and Tua and say, I want Brian Flores as the man in charge with the number one overall pick of quarterback? Now, maybe Fernando Mendoza and Brian Flores will be a perfect mix. I don't know. I think he's a great defensive coach. I think he should be a head coach again. But if I'm the Raiders, I at least have to think about that. Is that the right mix if I'm throwing in a rookie number one overall quarterback after seeing what happened in Miami?
I think it's absolutely fair. Question. Absolutely fair.
Yeah, and I think also you've got to ask yourself, like, one of the reasons I think that Brian Flores and Kevin O'Connell have worked so well in Minnesota is because they often talk about having different type of personalities on the same staff. Brian Flores is very fiery, and typically people's strengths are their weaknesses too, so that can be great and that can be awesome. Kevin O'Connell is much more laid back, but he's an excellent coach, and so it balanced out. To me, if you are going to make Brian Flores the head coach of the Las Vegas Raiders, you need to have an offensive coordinator working with the first overall pick who is going to play that good cop when Brian plays the bad cop. You have to have someone who is going to be reassuring. I'm not saying you got to baby them. And I actually think, and we'll get to my one more thing later about how I don't think players today want to be baby. And I don't think that's what they want their teammates to get. But I do think you would need to make sure to have that balance. And I would think that the Raiders, like Spytek and Brady, should want that. Like, I know that there was something floating around about, oh, do you get Brian Flores as head coach and defensive play caller and Brian Daboll as offensive play caller? And I think that's just way too much fire to have in one building. Although it would be funny, both from like the lawsuit standpoint and if the Raiders somehow managed to have like the only, there are two coaches who currently have pending lawsuits from a head coaching standpoint against the NFL. And they're John Gruden when he was last with the Raiders and Brian Flores. And
Brian
if they
got rid of
one and brought in another. But I also think like Mark Davis and Brady would not be past doing that, even if some owners would be like, you got to drop your lawsuit first. So I think it's interesting.
Mark Davis's dad lived
and to
for
be clear, I'm not
suing the NFL.
Lawsuit.
Like, he'd be proud. Like, hey, this guy's got a lawsuit. That's a check mark for
And to connect those dots, what Jory's explaining here, the whole lawsuit, part of the lawsuit at least, was, the errant text from Belichick saying, oh, sorry, Daboll's getting that job. So now you would put Flores and Daboll together in Vegas. I mean,
but on the other hand, both lawsuits, but if you have like one get fired because racist emails came out and then the other one's like the NFL's racist and you're like, no, we're not, we're hiring you. I mean, I don't know. Maybe everyone can tie up all the loose ends this way.
I mean, Law and Order. Something like that. I don't know. I don't watch the legal shows. My dad is a retired attorney and he would always like, you know, yell at the TV. This isn't real. Right. Like me watching sports movies. I can't stand sports movies because they're so fake. So I didn't watch Law and Order is my point. So I don't know if I was the right analogy for whether or not the Raiders situation You get what I'm saying? Okay, I'm rambling. Other news, there are reported interviews or requests already. Yeah, Robert Saleh reportedly has been requested by the Arizona Cardinals to interview there for their open head coaching job after Jonathan Gannon has been fired. Kevin Stefanski reportedly already has interviews lined up with the Giants as early as Wednesday and the Tennessee Titans coming up over the weekend. So, yeah, that carousel has begun to spun. Also, plenty of GM interviews. We'll dive into them a little bit later. Coming up next, the coordinator carousel keeps on spinning. Some of them expected, some of the moves not. That's next on Inside Coverage. Inside Coverage on Yahoo. Hi, I'm Andrew. Jory is here. Frank is here. And we're happy that you are here as well. Mentioned the John Harbaugh move. That is the stunner, but not a stunner, as he is out after 18 years as head coach of the Baltimore Ravens. The least surprising move, the least surprising move of this week, or maybe of any week, is that Matt Eberflus was relieved of his duties as defensive coordinator of the Dallas Cowboys on Tuesday morning. 1 year as DC, he was a former Dallas assistant, eventually became the head coach of the Chicago Bears. The Cowboys allowed 30.1 points a game this year. The Cowboys allowed 511 points this year. They were last in the league in points per game on defense and 30th giving up yardage, 30th in total defense. So yeah, you knew this was coming. At the same time, when your corners are hurt, when you trade away Micah Parsons, I mean, is there any sympathy here for Matt Eberflus? I like the guy. It clearly didn't work, and I don't know that the personnel fit the scheme. I think we knew that from the jump. And getting Quinn and Williams, Jory, helped. It helped. Certainly did. He played his tail off there down the stretch. But, I mean, there's no way this defense is giving up 30 points a game with Micah Parsons.
Yeah, it's interesting. Dak Prescott said after the Cowboys' regular season finale and their season finale on Sunday that this was the first time in his career that the Cowboys' success had not correlated with his individual performance when he's been healthy. And it's kind of like, our offense was one of the best in the league and we're still losing all these games. What do we do? I think the somewhat saving grace, although my sympathy is limited, for Matt Eberflus is that if you're going to say his personnel needs to, or his scheme needs to fit his personnel, you should probably give him a little more consistent and predictable personnel, which is to say that you should decide on Micah Parsons in the spring rather than a week before the season starts. And you should, you're bringing in Quinn and Williams, which helps, but it's still, you're not building that from the beginning of the season. That said, I do think, Andrew, that's the number one reason he's not coming back. It's not specifically about the production. Obviously, that matters. It's that there was not improvement throughout the course of the season. Yes, they had 2-3 games when Quinton got in there, when they also happened to play, by the way, like a Raiders team and an Eagles team whose offense was struggling, that they and a Chiefs team who we didn't realize quite how much they were struggling at that point, where we felt like the defense was turning around. But the reality is that this scheme did not fit the personnel, and it didn't adapt to fit the personnel over the course of the season. And that was something that the Cowboys brass could not overcome. And I think when you look at this, you just got to say, like, why didn't it fit the scheme? And it's actually funny because Trayvon Diggs, who's not with the Cowboys anymore, and he was released before week 18, was saying aloud that this is not the best skill set for me. Why are we playing zone? Why not man? The irony was that Trayvon had lost some credibility in the locker room, and particularly with the front office already, because he had violated parts of his contract by not attending offseason activities. He hadn't rehabbed in the way they wanted, etc. But his sentiment was accurate. And so I think that even though there's been way too much turnover at defensive coordinator for the Cowboys in recent years, there was kind of a change or a sense that this was not going to get fixed with Matt Eberflus.
Yeah, Andrew, I know how much you love DVOA, so I'm going to throw out a stat here. The Dallas defense...
I'm not anti-DVOA. I'm not anti-DVOA. Can I say real
not
quick?
Not anti-Steelers.
The only thing that kind of annoys me is I have a lot of dear friends in this business, many of whom are highly successful and highly talented, and I respect the heck out of them, who it's always the first club in their bag. Like, everything is DVOA. First word out of their mouth is DVOA.
EPA per play.
EPA per play.
But I will say that...
Go ahead.
the Cowboys from DVOA had the fourth worst defense ever. Like, for the 1978, at least, when they started tracking
so
it.
That means it's not good.
So, yeah, I get that. We can't take that for granted in today's NFL. Not everyone absolutely intercepts passes anymore.
No, man.
Especially when their coaches are DBs. Okay, continue.
Especially when they're
Jets. Especially when you're the Jets.
I mean, Matt Eberflus just wasn't going to come back. Like, you just can't have a defense that bad and come back. And not all of it was his fault. I totally agree there. But there's a results business. I've been ranting about this all day. I'd like to rant to you, too, because I think this is a point that deserves some time. Jerry Jones in 2018 had a quote where he said, "You know what? I would write a check so big it's embarrassing for me to win another Super Bowl." Well, Jerry, you have your chance here, because there's a guy in Minnesota whose contract is up. His name is Brian Flores. Mm-hmm. He is maybe the best defensive coordinator in all of football. And I can tell you, he's the best available defensive coordinator in all of football. We've talked before about how coaches are underpaid compared to players. The highest paid coordinator in NFL history, Chip Kelly, that didn't work out, but he makes 1/10 of what Dak Prescott makes. If you just go to Brian Flores and say, "You know what? You're a free agent. I know you're getting head coaching interviews, but what's it going to take? $12 million? $15 million? $20 million? Come on aboard. I'm willing to write that embarrassing check for you right now to win a Super Bowl." Jerry Jones keeps talking. "Oh, Super Bowl. That's all I care about. That's my only priority, winning a Super Bowl." Got your chance here. I get that. Owners like to play nicey-nicey, and nobody wants to reset the market. But Jerry Jones, if he is dead serious about winning a Super Bowl, Brian Flores is his defensive coordinator next season. That's just
important
as flatly
question,
as I
though
can put it. Yeah.
Can I ask you, though? We just talked about how Matt Eberflus didn't have the personnel to match his scheme, or he didn't match his scheme to the personnel. I get that Brian Flores probably could do whatever he wants, but Brian Flores is actually one of the few defensive coordinators who, when I ask people around the league about it, like, he has the Andrew Van Ginkel types. He has certain players who he actually needs to work to make his scheme work. I'm not saying it can't work, but for it to be excellent rather than very good, do you think this Cowboys personnel group actually is a good fit for Brian Flores?
I don't. I do not think it's, but I don't think it's a great fit for anybody, because I don't think our personnel is any good. Like, so I just bring in the best coach I can, because what I've been saying all day, and you guys know this, we all know this, but nobody takes advantage of it. There is no salary cap for coaches. It's the one advantage that no
totally
owner wants
it
to take advantage of. He could, if Jerry Jones wanted to spend $100 million on his coaching staff, nothing is stopping him, and it's not affecting his product on the field whatsoever. Jerry Jones, by a quick Google search, worth $20 billion. He can afford it. He just doesn't want to afford it. As Jory, you've talked about this a million times. He doesn't like paying coaches top dollar. So you're not really serious about winning a Super Bowl at that point. That's it. That's as plainly as I can put it.
Yeah, I also have faith. Look, it might take a year or two to retool, to your point, Jory, the defensive side, to truly get this battleship operational the way it should be. That was a Star Wars reference. Jory doesn't get Star Wars movies. That's okay. I kind of screwed up the quote anyway, but I threw it
in
there just because I felt like... Battle Station actually was the proper one. Battle Station. But I screwed it up. That's my whole point. I said Battleship and I messed it up. So, like, it's on me. 15 yards on me for bad Star Wars quotes. If you look at the guys that he's had success with in Minnesota, like Josh Metellus or Ivan Pace, like, these guys were not first round or second round or third round or fourth round or even fifth round picks. Okay. Although Pace,
you know,
Metellus was sixth round.
Do you know how many they've
he can make some of these picks?
Yes, he can.
And these guys
make them
work. Go ahead.
You know how many Pro Bowlers? You know how many Pro Bowlers Brian Flores had in his last three seasons as Minnesota Vikings defense
I'm
going to
guess none.
No, actually
none?
Four. Four. Van Ginkel made one. Greenard made one. Daniel Hunter made one. And Byron Murphy made one. Those were the four.
Okay.
None of those guys are super. There's no Miles Garrett in that group. Brian Flores elevates guys. Like, he is
imagine giving him a Miles Garrett.
And
he does. I don't think it's about the talent threshold. I think it's about the specific type of player. And look, maybe they can go get them, but I do think that's actually why Philadelphia wanted Zach Bond from New Orleans, because they saw what Flores was doing with Van Ginkel, and Vic Fangio had done that with Van Ginkel beforehand, and Fangio wanted that. They bring in Zach Bond. So I'm not saying that you can't do that. I don't think it's a talent, but I do think there are certain skill sets that in order for Brian Flores' defense to fully go off and fully take on his personality and take on his scheme, you do need those guys more than perhaps some other defensive coordinators.
Absolutely. Let's go to Washington here, because I have long felt... Washington, by the way, is my hometown, and I can't be happier that Jaden Daniels and Bobby Wagner and Terry McLaurin and even Austin Eckler a year ago when he was healthy kind of brought this team back and brought back a level of respect and decency and winning to this organization that an entire generation had lost. like lost. It was gone. And when Jaden Daniels and Dan Quinn and their first years together in Washington went to the NFC Championship game a year ago, it looked as if the future could not be brighter and they'd be doing this every single year. There were others of us who looked at the roster and went, hey, give Adam Peters and Dan Quinn credit. Peters, the new GM that year, because this roster's got holes and they went out and got some aging veterans like Bobby Wagner. They made this work, but this roster might need a few years here. And we saw that this year. Jaden Daniels got hurt. He played only 7 games. And their roster and their winning took a big step backwards. Anyway, long story short, Cliff Kingsbury is out as offensive coordinator. They decide to mutually part ways. And Joe Witt, who came with Dan Quinn from Dallas, is out, fired, as defensive coordinator. You'd have to think Quinn is going to take over the defense. He was down the stretch when he was taking over those play calling duties. To me, the Kingsbury thing is interesting. Jory, start with you here, because coming out of Arizona State, when they said we're going to pair you with Cliff Kingsbury, I'm like, or LSU rather, not Arizona State. I was like, man, like they're going to get him killed. You're going to get him killed in that offense. But people around the league all gave Cliff credit. They ran the ball. They were creative in their run game. Yes, they used Jaden's legs, but it wasn't nearly as much as some people had expected. And it worked. And then he got hurt. And then he took too many hits. And then I think they just realized this wasn't sustainable. But I do wonder aloud, if Jaden Daniels played more than 7 games, would Cliff Kingsbury still be the offensive coordinator?
It's a great question, Andrew, because Jaden had knee and elbow and hamstring injuries this year. And to me, I have some cynicism about this firing, not because I necessarily think they needed to keep going, but I did a story on Jaden going into the season for our Yahoo project of 25 game changers in NFL, 25 people shaping the NFL in 2025. And Jaden was one of them, because I felt like not only was Jaden's style of play really interesting in the NFL, but I felt like the structure the Commanders built around him in his rookie year was going to create a new infrastructure and a new model for how NFL teams want to bring their quarterback on, because they had this rare situation where it was new ownership, it was new head coach, it was new coordinator, it was new quarterback, all at the same time, new GM. And so they had sort of like no pre-existing ideas that they could really say, how do we want to build this? And I talked to all of them about this. I talked to DQ, Dan Quinn, I talked to Cliff Kingsbury, I talked to quarterback's coach DeVita Pritchard, I talked to Jaden about this. And there was this idea that how much could they carry over from what he'd done well in college, and how much could they ensure that they weren't asking Jaden to move from scheme to scheme and coach to coach as much as possible. And so on that staff, they had Cliff, who had been a former head coach before, with the idea that DeVita Pritchard, as the quarterback coach right under him, or Tavita is actually how you pronounce his name, could move up and use the same language for Jaden if Cliff got another head coaching job. And then you had guys like Brian Johnson, the former Eagles offensive coordinator, in the building already. Well, now Cliff is out by their choice, and Tavita is the Stanford head coach. And you have Jaden, who was injured this season, is going to have to learn a new system and have a new criteria. I mean, Jaden and Cliff at 6 a.m. every single day were having their own private walkthrough in the bubble, and Tavita was coming as well. Is the next coordinator going to do that? And I'm not even saying it's like on him if he doesn't. I'm just saying they had a system that I thought worked, and I think that it feels like we are judging too much based off a reactionary response to health, and health from Jaden and other guys on the field. And my cynicism largely stems from the fact that you need to have a process, and whether or not it works, you need to believe in what you believe in and have your principles. And I felt like coming off that first year, when clearly the NFC Championship and all the close games they won and the doink in and the Hail Mary probably inflated a little bit what they could do, but they rode the momentum as they should and they earned it. And there was kind of this belief of, oh, well, now we believe in this process because it worked. And then 1 year later in injuries, you don't believe in your process anymore. To me, I don't feel like this aligns with the plan that they all had talked to me about instilling. And forget talking to me. I'm just saying they said they believed in a plan, and I don't think that they're sticking to it.
Yeah, you said that perfectly. I mean, it is pretty startling that think about less than a year ago, the Washington Commanders were in the NFC Championship game, and they were the hot thing, and they were going to be everybody's pick to get even better in 2025, and it didn't happen. And, you know, there's obviously reports that Dan Quinn and Cliff Kingsbury weren't on the same page as far as run-pass balance. And I'm thinking, Jaden Daniels finished 5 games this year. Doesn't that mess with your play calling? Like, you're not calling a game the same way with Marcus Mariota. You just you're like, well, I got to do what I got to do to try to get us through this game. So judging Cliff on that was weird to me. This whole thing is just kind of weird. And I never have taken Dan Quinn as a reactionary guy like that. So I get the defense hasn't been good for 2 years. Like they weren't even good when they were, you know, making a wild card last year, making that run through the playoffs. The offense, though, I thought Cliff did a good job with Jaden Daniels. And for every point you said, Jory, like,
Marcus Mariota.
They were on the same page. Yes. Even Mariota. Mariota had his moments,
too. Mariota in that Denver game, like, they didn't look helpless without Jaden, which is impressive.
No. The opposite of helpless. Like, I'm watching Mariota down the stretch here. And don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to make him Tom Brady here. But I'm watching Mariota down the stretch. And I'm like, this guy's a lot different than the guy that, you know, didn't finish the season a couple of years ago in Atlanta. Like, you need a veteran leader on the bench who can get you through three or four games. Like, I feel a lot more comfortable with Marcus Mariota after this year in Washington with not a lot of parts around him than I did a couple of years ago.
Well, and on top of that, if you want to talk about the games Jaden did finish, one that comes to mind is their loss to the Cowboys. And it was a significant loss, like I think it was 20-something points. But not only was Jaden already injured previously in the season, he was playing without his top three receivers. And I think they were missing some offensive linemen too. And Dorrance Armstrong, their top pass rusher, was out. So there were injuries up and down the roster. And I just think that if you have injuries on your roster, yes, you need to figure out, hey, did we train them properly? Hey, what can we do about this? Were we taking too many gambles on older players, which the Commanders are one of the older rosters, if not the oldest roster in the league. But I don't think that all of these injuries now means that the play calls didn't work.
Yeah.
Let me throw this in here too. I'm not trying to suggest they're dysfunctional. I'm not saying that. But Jory, obviously you're like, this is a bit confusing. Maybe not confusing, but this isn't what I thought the path would be. This kind of feels like a move from the previous era of Commanders football, from the previous ownership. It's not a shot below the belt, but this is something that you came to expect 10 years ago. From this team. It might be the right move. Dan Quinn has earned the right to make this move. This is what he feels right about. But this is what fans came to expect, the constant turnover years ago.
I just wonder who they're getting next. I wonder what, okay, if part of this was Jaden keeps getting hurt because he's running too much, are you going to get a coordinator who doesn't want him to run? And then you've kind of taken one of the main superpowers Jaden Daniels has away from him.
Frank, I'm so glad you used the word superpower, because that is like Dan Quinn's thing, is that his job as a coach is to find the superpower. It's the word he uses in every single player. And Jaden's dual threat, or they often call it the triple threat with his mind as well, is what they said. And Dan talked all after they drafted him of he's a plus one for defenses. I never liked going against that as a defensive coordinator. And also, let's remember, defense was the main issue here, and the run-pass balance changes a lot if you are up in games versus if your defense is able to hold off and you have to do something about it. Now, you could say, hey, Dan Quinn thought that one of the defensive issues was they were scoring too. I mean, they weren't. I don't think this is the case. There are times when the head coach and the offensive coordinator disagree on the offensive distribution because the offensive coordinator is like, let me score. And the head coach is like, I also got to keep my defense fresh. And so maybe there was some disagreement. And I don't know this, but I've seen it happen before, of was the offense best allowing the defense to succeed too? But I don't know. This doesn't feel like it was the plan.
Okay. Final thought here on coordinators. I'm going to give you 30 seconds each. If you want 45, you could have 45. In the least surprising move, Alexander, other than Matt Eberflus here, the Lions have let go of offensive coordinator John Morton. And I say it's not surprising because the second half of the season, Dan Campbell took over play calling duties. That is kind of, sort of, a big deal. But the big storyline all offseason is, how do the Lions recover from losing both coordinators, Ben Johnson and Aaron Glenn? The answer is they don't make the playoffs, and now they're looking for a third OC, Jory, in 3 years.
Yeah, and it is a little bit funny because they were actually still top five in offense and in offensive scoring. But if you look at it, I believe it was November 9th that he first took it over. And it looks like they had, after that, 44, 34, 24, 44. Anyway, they did quite well after. So I think some of this was actually the way the offense was operating as opposed to their ability to score at all. But I think that Dan Campbell has more than earned the right to pick, like for us, more than earned the benefit of the doubt in his ability to pick the next coordinator. And he found Ben Johnson. He's done quite well with other guys. So I trust that he'll get this next one right.
Yeah, I think it was a totally fine move. He just wasn't working out, and you admit the mistake and move on. Like you said, Dan Campbell deserves some benefit of the doubt, but part of the problem is Ben Johnson. They're going to be chasing that dragon for a while. They're going to be saying, well, we had the number one offense with Ben Johnson, and now we went down to number eight or whatever they were this season, nine. Or, well, that's still pretty good. It's just not Ben Johnson because Ben Johnson happens to work somewhere else, and finding another Ben Johnson is going to be really tough. But they have so much talent that they're going to get a really, really good offensive coordinator candidate in there.
I had this daydream while sitting on a plane yesterday, and I want you to know it was no way it was happening. It was fantasy, pure fantasy. It was a daydream. No, like, insight as to anything going wrong in the Lions organization. But I had this daydream that maybe ownership and Dan Campbell could get in some kind of disagreement over coordinators, and or maybe the season ended and they spent all this money, and that maybe Dan Campbell would somehow be out in Detroit. And then he would take over the Browns. He used to be in the building many years ago. Actually used to catch passes for the Browns many years ago as well. It's not happening.
Actually, one last thing. If I'm the Lions, the first name I'm calling is Declan Doyle, the Bears offensive coordinator. He is the offensive coordinator of the Bears. Even Dan Campbell and others who worked with him in New Orleans have described him as another Ben Johnson. And they told Ben Johnson when he was interviewing him, you are Ben Johnson. But he's not a play calling offensive coordinator right now. But he spent a year with Ben. He understands what they've been doing in Detroit when it worked. And I mean, I did a feature on him earlier this season, just like off the charts in terms of organized, intellectual, still has the EQ, all of that. He's young. I think that's who they should be going after.
And if you're going to look at the young coordinators like that, or the guys that are in those roles that aren't necessarily calling plays yet, you look at him, you look at Grant Yudinski as well, who obviously learned, or if you don't know, he did learn under Kevin O'Connell in Minnesota. Look at those names. And Clint Kubiak is going to get his head coaching interviews as well. He got an interview for the OC job in Cleveland last year that eventually went to Tommy Rees. Kubiak was calling plays in New Orleans before that staff got blown out, and he is calling plays this year in Seattle. Coming up next, Tua Tagovailoa says dope when asked about playing somewhere else next year. Okay. Inside coverage continues on Yahoo. It's Inside Coverage here on Yahoo. Andrew Siciliano, Jory Epstein, and Frank Schwab. Big news of the day, John Harbaugh is out as head coach of the Baltimore Ravens. As of this hour, Mike McDaniel is still head coach of the Miami Dolphins, and Tua Tagovailoa is still the quarterback, although what does that really mean? Because there is no game to be played this week for the Dolphins. They are home for the playoffs. So Tua, in the clean out the locker room thing on Monday in Miami, was asked if he would like a fresh start. And the quote from Tua is, "That would be dope. I would be good with it." Barry Jackson, who writes for the Miami Herald, said that the reporters then made sure that Tua understood the question meant elsewhere, like a fresh start someplace other than Miami. And Tua basically kind of conceded he understood, he knew what the question was, but didn't want to speak beyond that. The dead cap hit for Tua Tagovailoa is like $90 million. Mike McDaniel, seemingly, Jory, is still the head coach. Like, is there an exit strategy? Would someone say, yeah, we'll take that contract off your hands? Or they're going to just have to cut him.
Yeah, it's a great question. Mike McDaniel was asked about this, too, in his end-of-year press conference. And he said, on one hand, the fact that Tua lost the starting job this year doesn't mean he can never get it back. But he also acknowledged that when you have a position as important as quarterback, you are going to have to explore the options. He certainly wasn't committing to Tua for next year. And he did suggest that they would bring someone else in for competition, whether or not someone already on the roster was there. So the finances of this will be interesting because it feels much more like Tua would be a bridge or a backup, unless there was a coach that just really believed in him. And I'm not even necessarily saying that his skill set leads to that, but I do think when you look at some of the guys who are going to be on the market, like Tua and Kyler and Kirk, and I know we'll get to them, they're not necessarily in the prime of their career, it doesn't feel like, nor do they come without any baggage from their previous stops. And so teams are going to have to ask themselves, how much do we believe in this guy if we're going to be paying him?
Yeah, absolutely. And Look, the writing was on the wall. When you demote a guy to third, you're saying, yeah, we're done here. We're not moving along with this anymore. And no, I don't think anybody's going to trade for that contract. But when he is available, and he will be, I don't know really where he lands. I was on Yahoo Sports Daily this morning, and they asked me about him and where might he go. I just don't have a great answer. One that pops to mind is Pittsburgh. I don't think Aaron Rodgers comes back for another year, although he did leave the door open the other day. They're cycling through veteran quarterbacks, trying to just find something. Maybe he fits there. I don't know. But Tua's going to be in a weird place this offseason where it's like, he's going to be available. Hey, I'm here. I led the NFL passing yards a few years ago. Was really, really good for a couple of years. And I don't know that there's any market for him, really, other than, hey, we need a stopgap for this, you know, until we can find a rookie who fits in, like the Steelers. If it's the Vikings who say, hey, we saw what the Indianapolis Colts did with Daniel Jones. They brought in a proven veteran to really, really push a young quarterback who hasn't really produced much. Maybe a situation like that. But yeah, Tua's had a very weird career. I feel bad for him because I do think concussions really derailed him. He has not been the same quarterback since that concussion early in the 2024 season against Buffalo. The numbers are night and day since that injury happened. I do think that affected him. So yeah, I don't know what's next for Tua Tagovailoa. And honestly, I don't know what's next for the Miami Dolphins either. Not like they can go out and pay Malik Willis. Like they're going to have to eat this cap hit. And I don't know how they fix the quarterback situation. It's a mess for everybody.
All right, so assuming Mike McDaniel stays there, let's go through some of these other interesting coaching/quarterback situations. I guess kind of just throw it out there, not vaguely, but just openly. You know, how does the coaching situation, the coaching search affect this quarterback situation and vice versa? Let's start in Cleveland with Shedeur Sanders. I spoke to Andrew Berry yesterday, and I kind of gave him an open-ended question. I said, how will your quarterback question affect your coaching search? And he made it very clear, obviously they're going to talk about the quarterback, but in no way was it like, you know, it's Shedeur or bust. And he said the same thing on the podium, that they want Shedeur to keep growing, certainly, but in no way did Andrew Berry said pound the table and said Shador's our quarterback and that's not negotiable with whomever we interview to be our next head coach. He doesn't speak in absolutes like that, if you know AB, but there was no, hey, it's Shedeur or the highway for any of our head coaching candidates. Jory, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I think it was pretty telling that neither Andrew Berry nor Jimmy Haslam or even the players who were speaking at the end of the season were saying that Shedeur was going to be the quarterback for next year. And I think that even though someone might just say, oh, well, who did they win more games with? And clearly Shedeur Sanders, they won more games with than Dylan Gabriel. When you actually look at their passing efficiency statistics, Shedeur does not compare significantly better than Dylan. He was a little more productive, but he was not more efficient. His touchdown to interception ratio was worse. And yes, they won that final season game, but that's because there was an interception return and a fumble return and field goals. So I'm not saying he didn't have any role in it, but I do think that's important context in terms of whether they feel like they've seen enough. I think that what the Browns' goal this year should have been and was evaluate the quarterbacks on the roster so they know what they need to do. Now you have the 6th overall pick. You have another first round pick. I think they will use some high pick on a quarterback. And I think Andrew Berry also philosophically believes you should take a quarterback pretty much every year. I talked to him about this in June during OTAs. And he's like, don't just take one every year, but you have to acknowledge you're not always going to get the quarterback position right. And it's so important that you should be taking more darts than you think you need. And so I do think that when you look at the guys really thriving in the league right now, they are largely first round picks. I've talked about the fact of how 12 of the 14 playoff quarterbacks starting were drafted in the first round. So I think that the Browns probably realize we do need someone we can build on, but we're not going to make that decision until we have our coach in place.
Yeah, I don't know how this doesn't affect our search. I mean, one thing we've talked about through the offseason was Shedeur Sanders is not your typical fifth-round pick. There's a lot of outside noise with him and everything that goes with him. And I think that will affect who they can land, because the Browns did have that great rookie class. Andrew, you talked about it yesterday and you tweeted about it over the weekend. And that's the selling point, I guess. You say, hey, we'll figure out the quarterback situation at some point. If Shedeur works out, he works out. If he doesn't, he doesn't. You're not stuck with him. You're not married to him. You're not sink or swim with him. You might have to deal with him for a year, though, because we don't really think there's a quarterback at number 6 who's worth it, and not in this class. I don't think there is. Maybe they do move up, but is Mendoza really worth it? Is anybody even drafting in the top 3 willing to trade a pick if they, if they need a quarterback. I don't know the answer to that. So I think it's going to affect their search, and I think it's going to come down to, hey, we'll figure out the quarterback situation later, but we'll have patience with you because it might not be pretty in the meantime.
Yeah, and as for the Browns' second draft pick, it's the Jaguars' number one pick. The Jaguars obviously are in the tournament here. They're not the number one seed in the AFC. That goes to the Denver Broncos. Jacksonville is number three. The best that pick could be is 23. And the only way that pick is 23 is if both the Jaguars and the Patriots lose this weekend. And then the pick would be number 23, potentially. But is 23 enough to go from six up to one or two? I don't know. I could say this too as well. There is a lot of noise, obviously, on social media, and people are very passionate about Shedeur Sanders one way or the other. He's a good kid. He works hard. He does not really get involved with all that. And I can tell you that it isn't a distraction in the locker room. It really isn't. It's not something people talk about. It's no one is like, oh, my God, that guy. No one says that. The guy works hard, and he's a rookie quarterback. Sometimes he makes plays, sometimes he doesn't. The overall metrics between Shedeur and Dylan Gabriel at the end of the season came out very similar. However, the big difference with Shedeur compared to Dylan Gabriel was his ability to get the ball downfield, was to create the explosives. Now, there weren't as many of them down the stretch as there were the first couple of weeks, but he was able to push the ball downfield, and that is something that the Browns offense did not have with Gabriel or with Joe Flacco early in the season. They also had clear offensive line deficiencies, injuries, and otherwise. I'll say this, too, about the Browns. Jory, to your point about taking as many quarterbacks as you can and have as many in the building as you can, if you go back to training camp, the Browns had five quarterbacks in their building that not only started games, but won games this year. Dylan Gabriel started in one. Shedeur Sanders started in one. Joe Flacco started in one. Granted, it was in Cincinnati, but he did win the game as well for the Browns over the Green Bay Packers. And Tyler Huntley started in one. And week 18, Kenny Pickett started and won. Five quarterbacks in their building in training camp that started and won games. All right, let's blow through these here. Kyler Murray, Jory, we tapped the base a little bit yesterday when you were not here. The Cardinals are looking for a new head coach, and they might be looking for a way to get out of that contract as well.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if he's back. It will depend on what the head coach wants, but I think that this has been moving towards a divorce for years. And I also think if you're Kyler and they weren't playing you down the stretch the same way Max Crosby should have feelings in Las Vegas, whether or not those materialize, I think Kyler will have feelings in Arizona.
All right. And why don't you take Jackson Dart, Frank? What do you think?
I like Jackson Dart. I don't know what the issue is here, really. You use a first-round pick on a quarterback. He has a 91.7 passer rating, runs the ball really well. I don't know what more you expected from him. Did you expect him to be Jaden Daniels out of the gate? Like, yeah, he gets hurt. He's got to change his style a little bit. That's not perfect, but I don't know what more you expected out of Jackson Dart. If you're going to use a first-round pick on a guy and he plays like that, yeah, you got to see that through. And I think that any candidate has to know that, right? You're not just moving on from a first-round pick after, again, he just had a 91.7 pass rating and played pretty well in spurts over, 10 starts or whatever he had. All this stuff about, I don't think Jackson Dart's the long-term answer for the Giants. Haven't we learned from this? Haven't we learned from this, microwave analysis of quarterbacks? Give him some time. I thought he did some good things. I don't think it's a negative. I think candidates will look at Jackson Dart and say, I could work with him.
Yeah, and especially considering Joe Shane's not going anywhere. He's still the GM, and Joe Shane drafted him last year in the first round, traded back up into the first round to take him. It's Jackson Dart. Let's ping pong on these. You want to take Cam Ward, Jory?
Yeah, I think that Cam Ward is a more attractive element of this job than he was when they first fired Brian Callahan. When I talk to people around the league, they say that Cam has looked good out of structure all year, but in terms of the in-structure plays, the design plays, his accuracy, his patience, his, hey, take the easy completion sometimes, he really was growing. We've talked on the show about what his stats looked like the first 13 weeks of the season versus the end, and while I did get a little bit nervous this week when he had the shoulder injury that took him out of the end of the week 18 game, they said it was an AC joint sprain that should not influence him for next year. I've been around quarterback, so I've had that before. It's fine, especially if you don't need to return that season. And so I don't expect that to be a long-term issue. I think that the roster as a whole in Tennessee is not so appealing, but I do think Cam Ward is appealing.
All right. And now let's all give our 2 cents on Kirk Cousins, who was on the show yesterday. He said he could still play, still wants to play. Didn't say that he had spoken to Matt Ryan yet. Didn't say he wanted to come back to Atlanta. But Kirk Cousins, I think, he was 5-3 down the stretch, proved that he's worth it next year somewhere. He could be a starting quarterback. They restructured his deal today, or at least the news came out today. So there's now a guaranteed amount of $67.9 million for the 2027 season. So 2 years from now, that's going to vest on March 13th. No team is going to trade for that contract now. So March 13th is now the key tipping point on the Kirk Cousins contract. I've already connected the dots on Kevin Stefanski. A little on and off the air here. I'm not saying he's going to be the next head coach of the Falcons. However, he coached Kirk Cousins in Minnesota. Kirk Cousins just proved that he could still win in Atlanta with the weapons they have on that offense. Matt Ryan, Kirk Cousins, they know. I don't know. Jory, it is interesting.
Oh, it's definitely interesting, especially because I think that you want a quarterback to develop down the road. I don't know how many more years Kirk has in him. But I would trust Kirk to win games with this cast and with Kevin Stefanski at the beginning of next season. He just did it at the end of this season. And there is some chatter about, hey, did the Falcons make this decision before the end of the year? They have their consulting firm, et cetera, et cetera. I think that Kirk should be considered a viable starter at the beginning of the season for this team.
Yeah, I mean, Michael Penix might not even be healthy. And we don't know if Michael Penix is
might not be ready
yet. He was really up and down. Yeah. So I was skeptical about Kirk at his age, the way he looked 2024, but he did play well down the stretch. He looked like pretty much like Kirk Cousins again. Could you squeeze another year out of him at age 38? Probably, I guess, the way he played. So, yeah, but he's one of the more fascinating kind of dominoes of the offseason, whether it's back in with the Falcons or somewhere else. He's going to be maybe the key name to watch outside of like Malik Willis, who's everybody's excited about. Very, very interesting offseason for Kirk Cousins and for the Falcons.
Hey, how about Vegas? You know, I bet Kirk kind of wanted to go to Vegas last year, from what I understand. Just throwing it out there. If you're the Raiders and you have so many holes, if you're in love with Mendoza or Dante Moore, Moore hasn't even necessarily declared, and Mendoza can go back, but let's say those are the guys at the top. If you're the Raiders and you're not absolutely sold on one of those two, I know Orlovsky today called Mendoza generational. Like, he thinks he's that good. Well, go get Kirk Cousins and use that top pick and the rest of your draft haul to rebuild the rest of your roster. I'm just saying, whether it's Vegas or Minnesota or Atlanta or wherever, he proved that he can still play. Because he didn't look good last year when it all fell apart down the stretch. He proved he could still play. I think it's interesting. That's just me. And by the way, good work, Yahoo team, in getting Kirk Cousins on the show yesterday. That was huge. All right, guys, we have time for one more thing before we go. Jory, start with you.
Yeah, I think that the word accountability, we should all be keeping an eye on in this coaching search. It sounds cliche. It especially sounds cliche when a GM or a team owner or someone uses it. But multiple players this week were using that. There were players on the Browns who, when they were asked, what do you want in your next head coach? They said they wanted someone who was going to focus on accountability. I'm not saying that was a shot at Kevin Stefanski. I'm just saying that was something they specifically singled out. There were players on the Las Vegas Raiders who, when they were asked, said, we need someone who's going to hold us accountable. And even in Miami, where accountability has been a question mark and Mike McDaniel appears to be keeping his job, he was asked, why are you joking around less than usual? And he goes, look, I'm still here, but I recognize that I need to be a little more serious at the end of the season, because that's what people needed when we were losing. And so for as much as this generation of players, one, gets kind of a bad rap for their lack of accountability, and two, some of them do need that because they're coming in with the NIL money and they've already been stars, and some of them seem to act like they've arrived and they don't want to practice, and we've seen the examples. I think that for every player on the team who might not be looking for accountability, they kind of just want to do it their way. I think there are a whole host of players around them who want a coach who's not just going to hold that player accountable, but also their teammates.
Yeah, it's a great point there. I'm glad you brought it up. And I was just laughing here because I was thinking of Mike McDaniels, the funny man on the podium. I'm thinking, what was my favorite Mike McDaniels line ever of all time on the podium? Oh, yeah, it was like a random Wednesday when he was asked by a Dolphins reporter, hey, Mike, what's your relationship like with the officials? And he goes, not monogamous. I'm like, yep, there's that guy. And then he kept going and no one even laughed. And I'm like, why is no one laughing? Why am I the only one laughing?
He's great.
I digress. Frank, one more thing.
I just, we haven't talked a lot about the playoffs. Hey, the playoffs start this week, by the way. There's just been so much going on. Yeah. Hey, wow. There's just been so much else going on around the NFL. So I'm not joining you the rest of the week. So I did want to get this out of the way. I've seen this bubbling up on social media this week, this whole notion of, hey, if Josh Allen doesn't win a Super Bowl this year without Joe Burrow and Lamar Jackson and Patrick Mahomes in the playoffs, and he's failed. This is a big failure for Josh Allen. First of all, why are we pre-cooking this narrative? This is dumb. Like, don't do this. Like, that's ridiculous. Can we let the games play out before we get to our narratives? And B, is a pet peeve of mine. I will talk about it all the time. Quarterback is the most important position in football. It is not the only position in football. It's a team game. That's what makes the NFL beautiful. It is a team game. You're telling me the Bills go out and give up 250 rushing yards to the Jaguars and lose? You're going to come out here and say, well, Josh Allen failed. He didn't make a Super Bowl. That's ridiculous. Don't do this. My plea to everybody out there is see beyond the quarterback position. Actually watch football for what it is. It's a team game. Yes, a quarterback gets the most attention. He gets the most blame, gets the most credit. That's all fair and well. But it goes beyond the quarterback. And definitely, I don't, maybe Josh Allen throws five interceptions and we can't all say, well, he failed because he had a shot at this thing and he didn't get it done. But let's let it happen first and let's watch the game for what it is. It is 53 guys working together. That's what makes the NFL great. It's not all on the quarterback shoulders. I'm already annoyed. I'm already annoyed at this Josh Allen narrative and it hasn't even happened yet. So
I'm just
my plea is, watch the game. It's not just not a tennis match between quarterbacks, people. Okay.
I am stunned, Frank, that you're already annoyed. It is just
I just wish Sierra were here to get annoyed with you getting annoyed.
He would too. He actually agreed with me yesterday on something, Jory. It was great. It was historic.
We need like a do breaking news. Okay. My one more thing is this. Back to Dan Campbell.
Not good enough. We didn't get in. I mean, we underachieved, so not good. I would give myself a freaking F.
Not just an F, but a freaking F. An F.
I just want, like, someone close to him to give him a hug.
He does need a hug. Yeah, I think everyone in Detroit needs a hug. But I also think that the other 31 coaches need to adopt what Dan Campbell just did. I think all NFL head coaches, all 32 of them, need to end the season, their end of year press conference, by giving themselves a grade. A grade. I want a grade. Give me a grade. And you could be the guy that's like the self-promoter that gives yourself an A every year. Like the college coaches, every recruiting class ever put together by a college coach is the greatest recruiting class of all time in program history. There's never been a greater recruiting class. But I want these coaches to be honest, whether it's an A or a freaking F or a C, whatever it is. I want them to grade themselves, much like in Southern California or in California, you have to have a letter grade from the health department of the window. Now, you could argue with the health department, but like the grade's got to be out there. So I want these coaches to own the grade. And then fans can discuss and shows like this can discuss. I'm just asking for them to provide us more content, actually. But I think the fans would appreciate it. I give this show today. Well, I give you two an A. Jory, you get an A. Frank, you get an A. I'll give myself a B. I'll try to do better.
I cared a lot about my grades in school, like to the point where my parents were like, can you please get a B? But yeah, so thank you for the A.
Wow, look at that low-key flex. Look at that low-key flex.
My family
was a humble brag. That was a humble brag.
Come home with a B every now and then.
I was so good at school. My parents were like, can you just
I was so good at school that I annoyed my parents.
Actually, last thing that we can get off of this, in middle school, one of my teachers once called my parents and told them to not let me study more than 2 hours for the test because the teacher didn't believe it. So this was more a work ethic matter than it was a performance.
You can study 2 hours for a test?
And if you'd like to know how I went to school, and probably Madison can attest to this because we worked together at NFL Network and on this show, and most people that I've ever worked with can attest to this as well. I would study the final 30 minutes in the cafeteria before the test and then go get the B+ or A-, and then go home and go like, if I actually had worked, I probably could have gotten like the real A. Instead, I'm like, I pulled it off. I got a B. I'm like, because I took joy in being able to go, when's the show start? 5 minutes from now? I'm going to pull this off. Let's go. That's just me. For Jory, straight A's, and Frank, nothing but smiles.
I didn't say that.
My name is Andrew. Thanks for listening to and watching Inside Coverage on Yahoo. See you tomorrow.